Chariot TechCast number 92, Steve Klabnik on the Rust programming language. Welcome to the TechCast. I'm producer Becca Refford. We talked this week to upcoming Philly emerging tech speaker Steve Klabnik about the Rust programming language. Steve wrote the Rust guide and contributes to the Rust documentation, and is a core team member joining in December of 2014. TechCast host Ken Rimple spoke to him about how the language is viewed from three different perspectives: systems programmers, functional programmers, and dynamic language developers. Steve talks about tools such as Cargo and IDE support, how the language checks for safety and code during compile time, how it can provide C-level performance while giving developers features such as functional programming semantics, safe pointers, and can provide compiler extensions for supporting various features not yet inbuilt to the language itself. Steve will be speaking at Philly ETE. His talk is entitled Rust in Production.
All right, well, Steve Klabnik, welcome to the Chariot TechCast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So today we want to focus on your talk. You're speaking at Philly Emerging Tech in April, and your talk is on Rust. Now, Rust is a programming language, but this one's a little bit different in that it's not a language as heavyweight as something like a Ruby or a Java or something like that. It's built for things like system programming, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. There's a number of different ways to look at Rust, and one of the problems is we sort of have three kind of primary audiences. And, you know, like marketing, they always tell you to focus your message onto one, you know, thing. Yeah. So we've been having some trouble doing that because there's sort of distinct advantages for each one of these three different groups. Mm-hmm. And so since we have the time, I wouldn't mind going through those three different sort of approaches into Rust, because I think that you lose a lot of the audience if you only do one of them.
Yep.
So here's the three. The three groups, roughly speaking, are systems programmers, functional programmers, and Ruby, Python, JavaScript, Perl, PHP, like dynamic scripty language users.
Gotcha.
And so all three bring different things to Rust, and they all get different things out of it. So the systems programming is the one that people usually talk about with Rust, and that's because that's why Mozilla is interested in Rust and why they're funding its development. So let's do that one first. So Firefox is about 4 million lines of C++ code, and it's really old. You know, the Firefox code base is getting up there in age at this point in time, and it has lineage to even older projects. So, you know, it's not that its code is bad, but C++ is a very, very sharp tool. And, you know, like, if you use sharp tools, you will get cut by them eventually. Like, it's just an inevitability, right? And
right.
So that's not necessarily a flaw exactly, because programming languages are all about trade-offs. And so historically speaking, the only way to accomplish certain tasks has been to use extremely sharp tools. So a web browser is increasingly becoming like almost an operating system, and I won't even get into that right now, but the point is that you need to be able to do all sorts of stuff, and you need to be able to do it efficiently. Like the way that web pages are growing in size and capability, if you look at the web as it was in the mid-90s versus the web today, you know, there's a really good blog post I read by someone that was talking about how they were covering blog posts that were talking about how web pages are too bloated these days. And they're like, this blog post is 2 megabytes. This blog post is 3 megabytes. And like, even the blog posts of the people that care about page size are still like multiple megabytes in size.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Well, they're desktop applications now, really.
Right, exactly. And so we become increasingly demanding on what web applications can actually do. And so browsers need to be able to do this very, very efficiently. But almost as important, and some might even argue more important, is they need to be able to do it securely as well. So like when you download a website, you're downloading a full programming language, JavaScript, and running it in your computer. And so that has a great capacity for danger. And so doing a sort of security analysis on Firefox, we got some people, you know, obviously only certain subset of people are allowed to see the like super serious bugs tracker.
Yeah.
But you got one of those people to do a quick analysis on it. And about half of the super serious issues in Firefox all boiled down to C++ is a very sharp tool and it cuts you sometimes. So this is things like iterator invalidation, use after free, all kinds of like memory safety issues like that. And so Rust is an attempt at making a programming language that gives you the same speed and security, although again, security means a bunch of different things. So like, this is a short podcast, so not all Rust code will ever be secure. Rust applications will have security vulnerabilities. It's not about absolute security, but it's about eliminating a certain chunk of them that boil down to you use your programming language incorrectly. And that's really, really important. And so the only language that's really suitable for writing a web browser in is C or C++ today, basically. And so now we hope it is also Rust as well. And sort of the reason for that is because when you need this hyper-efficiency, you can't afford things like garbage collectors, or you can't afford things like heavy runtimes. And obviously, you know, the JavaScript engine has a garbage collector for the JavaScript, but you want to try to minimize that as much as possible and, you know, throughout the rest of your browser. And so it's like in that sort of trade-off, you have to go for the low-level stuff, and those things have been very sharp. So to systems programming, sort of what Rust gives you is the ability to eliminate a large class of vulnerabilities, but also just problems at compile time. And that's sort of the big, big advantage. And the compile time reason matters because that means that they have no runtime overhead. So for example, in Rust, you don't usually use raw pointers like you would in C++. Or in C++, you also have smart pointers too, and there's like details we could get into about that. But let's say C instead of C++, just to make this first part easier. In C, you use regular pointers, and those could be invalid, and you have to keep track of where they're valid or invalid. And so in Rust, we actually compile time check where your pointers are pointing and guarantee that at all times they are always valid. And since it's a compile time, that means it compiles into a regular old raw C pointer. The outputted code is not actually any different. It's just that we've done all the checking beforehand.
So there's a ton of static type and static code analysis.
Yeah, exactly. And so this means that we can be significantly safer while being as efficient, or in some cases, and hopefully this gets increasingly true in the future, even more efficient than C or C++ can be due to these kinds of analysis things. And so, like for example, I don't like citing the computer benchmarks game because people always cite it whenever they're winning, but whatever, everyone does it, so I'm going to do it too. Like, we currently have the fastest regular expression program, period, on the benchmarks game. We're beating the C and C++ programs at task.
No, you just said that, so here we go.
Yeah, exactly. So if everybody else does it, I'm going to do it too. And it's important micro benchmarks are not real benchmarks and all the other things that come along with that, but just like it is feasible. And generally speaking, it is a bug if Rust is significantly slower than C or C++ for a given task. And by significant, I mean like order of magnitude or less is what we expect to be at all times. And that's like a really big deal.
Yeah.
And so that's why Mozilla is interested, and that's sort of why they're funding the development of Rust, is because that we're also rewriting this web browsing engine, Servo, in it at the same time, and also slowly replacing pieces of Firefox with Rust code. Those have landed, but they're not shipping yet. They're sort of behind a compiler flag, and we hope to be shipping them this year to ship parts of Firefox actually in Rust. So that's going to be really exciting. So that's the high-level overview for the systems people. Next, I'm going to go to the functional people, because this is also part of what makes... Well, let's do the scripting ones first. This is sort of my personal bread and butter. I sort of became known in the programming world through my work on Ruby. Mm-hmm. And I learned C as a kid, but sort of once I found scripting languages like PHP and Ruby, I was like, I'm never doing this low-level stuff again. This is stupid. I don't have to worry about pointers anymore. Oh my gosh, this is amazing. And so I've been doing Ruby for the last couple years, and... The thing that we bring, so like the systems people bring this sort of low level knowledge, and also like, you know, we can't have any overhead kind of thing. What the Ruby, Python, JavaScript people see in Rust and bring to Rust is, I can write in a programming language that is stupid fast compared to my existing programming language. And while it's a little more complicated, the trade-off is worth it for me. And also, you can write, for example, Ruby or Python or PHP extensions in Rust itself. And so historically, in Ruby world at least, we've always said Ruby is very slow, but that doesn't matter most of the time. But then like every once in a while, it actually does matter. So then you drop down into C and you write a C extension. But a lot of times I've seen teams and people reluctant to do that because, again, C is a very sharp tool. We're programming in Ruby because we don't want to be programming in C. And like I can't trust myself necessarily to write production grade C code. And so I maybe don't do it as often as I should. And so Rust kind of gives them the ability to drop down into a low-level language for performance when you need it without it being as terrifying as the idea of like shipping C or C++ code. And part of this is because if you get a seg fault in a C extension, it takes down your whole app.
Yeah.
And that's not cool.
Kind of not a good thing.
Yeah. And so one of the first production users of Rust was Tilda with Skylight.io. It's a product that's sort of like New Relic, but only for Rails apps. And they're mm-hmm. focusing on one vertical because that way they can give you a better experience when they know, you know, just one thing. But that team Which Yehuda Katz is now a core member of Rust because he like worked on this. Basically, they wrote a prototype Ruby extension. So it has to, you install their gem in your application and it reports back to their servers with the performance info, and then you can look it up in a dashboard, basically. So when you install their monitor, they wrote the first version in C++, and then they were like, are we confident enough that we are not going to crash our customers' applications with this C++ code? I don't think that we have the expertise to actually know this. And so by moving to Rust, they gain a significant amount of confidence that their code works correctly and that won't actually happen. And so it's been a really big boon to them. They tried it in Ruby at first, and it was too slow, and there's other problems with doing that kind of thing in Ruby directly. So they're pretty much stuck between a rock and a hard place until they found Rust. And, you know, so it's been in production ever since, like 2 years or something now, I think.
So you get the low-level benefits of a C++, but the safety coming in from Rust basically saying you can't write pointers that walk off the edge of something and you can't screw up memory allocation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's for someone that does not do low-level programming as often, yeah. Or even people that do, that's just a very, very comforting thought. I actually usually like to joke that I'm not good at programming in Rust. I'm just good at reading Rust's error messages, because once you trust that the compiler is double checking your work, right. A lot of times I won't think about it too hard. I'll just type out whatever comes out in my brain, and then I know that if the compiler doesn't yell at me, it's okay. And when it does, I just fix whatever it pointed out. You know, it's sort of like it shames you.
Yeah.
A lot of people describe this as fighting the compiler, but I don't like to think of it as fighting. I like to think of it as a good friend who's like watching out for you and tells you like, hey man, right. You should do that. It's a bad idea. And like, you know, then you have the option to either listen to it or not. So I actually think it's a very friendly relationship, even though a lot of people describe it as fighting. Mm-hmm. So that's what Rust brings to the scripting crowd. What the scripting crowd brings to Rust is a respect for user interface and like usability. So for example, we got the Yehuda, who wrote Bundler in the Ruby world, to write Cargo for us, which is basically just like Bundler, NPM, but for Rust code. And so when you're writing Rust, you don't like use make files, and you don't deal with all that build stuff. You say if there's like a central package repository that has open source packages you can use. You say, I want to use this package at this version. And then it just automatically downloads, builds it, and links it in your application for you. There's none of that like tweaking your make files with config settings and setting up a Git submodule and all that kind of stuff that you end up having to do in a lot of low-level programming as well.
Yeah.
And so we sort of, a lot of the people that come from dynamic language backgrounds really care about usability, and so their perspective is to point out when the low-level people are making decisions that would be like terrible to actually use in practice. There's been a lot of input from the scripting language people around usability that has been really, really great for the language overall.
That's tremendous.
I think this is an overall theme, I guess, of these three groups, is that each one sort of brings something to the table to Rust as well as getting something out of it. And so I think they're all like equally important. And so lastly, the functional people. The functional programmers have what they get out of Rust is a language similar to the way that dynamic people do that is often significantly more performant than their existing language. A lot of functional style programming relies really heavily on garbage collection, and they're able to make that work. Like GHC's garbage collector for Haskell is amazing. It does like so much. It's so good at allocating and then deallocating a lot of memory very quickly, because you need to do that when you're writing in Haskell, basically. There's like lots of that going on. They've done a good job of optimizing it, but we're sort of, you know, you can program in a functional-ish style while getting C performance instead of functional language performance. And that's like a very beneficial thing to them. And what they brought to the table is the deep understanding of static analysis and type systems that enables us to do this kind of super high speed without cost. So we have a type system that's very heavily influenced by a lot of functional languages, although not as powerful as all of them. And sometimes those people get annoyed that we don't have all the bells and whistles that newer functional languages have. But it's sort of enabled us to build those kinds of abstractions in that sort of way. And so those are sort of the three groups and how it all fits in broad strokes, obviously. And it's hard because if you're like, oh yeah, you should use Rust anytime you use C. The people that don't use C all the time are like, cool, I'm never using Rust then.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I've had friends of friends say, like, Rust solves problems I never want to have, which is, like, to a certain degree true. But with one of the interesting things about the way that static typing has been perceived over the last, say, decade is that, like, a lot of people's experience with static typing is the, like, mid-90s version, like Java, for example.
Mine, yeah.
I don't like to pick on Java a lot because I think that it's got a lot of great things in it, and I think that it's a good language for what it's trying to accomplish. But it sort of has a very basic static type system, and people are used to it being more of a hassle than a benefit. And so we do things in Rust like a significant amount of type inference. And so you rarely ever write types in Rust code except for at function boundaries. So like what we found is that by forcing you to write out the type signature of a function, you almost never need to write types inside of the function itself. And that provides a really nice balance of guaranteeing this kind of safety while not being a giant pain in the butt to actually use.
Yeah.
And that's really, really important. And so a lot of people I know have sort of said, like, yeah, I don't care that much about the low-level stuff, but I do care about a language that's pleasant to use and is stupid, stupid fast. There's a friend of mine, Sean Griffin, is currently the active record maintainer for Rails. He's been writing an ORM in Rust, and it's called Diesel. And he actually has certain cases that, again, he's hoping to expand, where his ORM is actually faster than literally handwriting the SQL yourself, which is, like, totally mind-blowing.
That is mind-blowing.
The specific reason in this instance is based around prepared statements how at runtime, if you give a literal SQL string, it has to actually compile it. But he can, at compile time, turn the SQL into the pre-compiled form that
sort
of procedure would need. And so it actually ends up being faster at runtime, which is totally ridiculous. But those are the kind of things that we can do with really strong type systems, is like no overhead, incredibly safe stuff. And it's just really exciting overall.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the tooling. So you mentioned Cargo as the dependency manager. And I did just a little cursory round of playing this morning with the Hello World sample and things. And it is nice not to write a makefile, I can tell you that. But in terms of, you know, development tools, so when you're writing Rust programs, are you a Vim user or an Emacs user? Or what do you like to use for your editor tools and such?
So I personally am a Vim user. I sort of paid the cost of learning Vim back in college. And
me too.
So I never really looked
high
back.
School, believe it or not. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And for me, it was like NetHack was the thing that got me to actually learn to use Vim for real, like after a while. But so we do have really good support for Vim and Emacs and text editors like that. But we also are, we understand that many people are not Vim users because, mm-hmm. you know, because if you used Vim, you know why some people are not Vim users, as much as I love it.
The shift key.
And, yeah, yeah. And so we have an increasing amount of tooling that's going in for users of IDEs. So what's been nice is that also a lot of the IDEs are becoming more extensible. So, for example, just a couple of months ago, Microsoft finally released this thing called IME for the integrated something, I don't remember. But it basically lets you like plug GDB into Visual Studio and use Visual Studio's front end to drive things that understand how GDB works. So we kind of got nice Visual Studio integration, not totally for free. The work to make that actually work well is still kind of ongoing, but at least in the future, and sort of today, you can like use Visual Studio's visual debugging tools with Rust code, for example.
That's very cool.
Someone has made a custom version of Eclipse called RustDT that it's like a big plugin. You can install it in your Eclipse or download, you know, an Eclipse with it pre-installed. And you get all the integration with Eclipse stuff. And there's a project called Racer that does autocomplete generally, and then you can plug it into whatever IDE you're using. And we're looking at it and other tooling generally to do the kinds of things where, like, you have an Oracle that's running in the background, and it's the one looking at the Rust code, and the IDE queries the Oracle for things like autocompletes and stuff like that. That work is currently being undergone by a number of people, and so we're sort of still in the semi-early days for like truly awesome integration, but we have big dreams and aspirations for the future. So, you know, that stuff is coming along.
What about some of the, what you would think are non-traditional uses of Rust? I thought I read about compiler extensions. So
yeah,
what would you do with a compiler extension?
So what compiler extensions allow you to do is they allow you to plug into the compiler directly and sort of, I should put it this way. It allows you to invent new syntax, but in a scoped fashion. Ooh. So one of the things that's really important, and this also ties into the tooling story as well, is that we want to enable, like, macros and syntax extensions are useful language features because they allow you to extend a language before we're able to get around to writing something up for real, right? So, like, they let you sort of invent sort of new syntax. Mm-hmm. But what's important is they give you what looks like a function, except for it's got an exclamation point at the end, and the new syntax has to go inside of the parentheses. So, like, you'll see, to use an example earlier, we were talking about the ORMs in SQL, there is a compiler extension for SQL that you say SQL bang parentheses, and then you write a literal SQL string on the inside, and then a close parentheses. And so what's inside those parentheses gets passed to a compiler extension, which then can compile that SQL at compile time and double check that your syntax is correct.
Okay.
So if you, like, mistype select, the compiler will actually error out and say you misspelled select here, which is, like, really, really awesome.
That is very cool, yeah.
And it lets you sort of arbitrarily hook into the compiler this way. One of the better known syntax extensions is Clippy, which is named after the Microsoft, you know, helper.
yeah.
And it has over 100 lints that people have found useful that we don't include in the main distribution, and includes several levels of, like, how pedantic do you want to be. And mm-hmm. so you can, like, use it as a compiler plugin that then will end up linting your code and pointing out possible errors if you want.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's neat. Compiler extensions are not yet stable, but we're working on it. Obviously, when you allow people to hook into your compiler, you need to have an actual stable interface for how you hook into the compiler, and we're not totally satisfied with where it is right now. And actually, that's also another thing that would be interesting to talk about. I don't know if you want to talk about it.
I just was going to actually interrupt you for that, because I'm playing around with a guessing game sample as I'm doing this, and .expect, right? I installed 1.3. And I guess that's your exception handling to a degree, the expect function.
Sort of.
Maybe. But anyway, it said, error, use of unstable library feature result expect.
Yeah.
Newly introduced the issue, and they give an issue number, which is kind of cool.
Right.
So let's talk about a stabilization process.
Yes. So one of the things that's plagued C++ and other languages as well is that major versions are, like, hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost not really, like, the way that I think about major version changes is that it's a totally separate product, because you're effectively asking your users to rewrite their code just to update to your thing, and that's the same as porting to some other library entirely, basically. And so there's always been this sort of this tension between, we don't want you to pay to upgrade, and we're going to force you to upgrade all the time. So in Ruby world, Rails has been getting much better at this lately. But historically speaking, upgrading Rails is, like, a really big giant pain.
Yes.
And it's hard. So we sort of believe that we kind of have an answer to this problem. And that answer is called the train release model. So we took this from Firefox and Chrome, both do this. And so what happens is that so Rust 1.0 came out on May 15th, 2015. And then 6 weeks later, we released a Rust 1.1. And then 6 weeks later is a Rust 1.2. And then 6 weeks later is 1.3, and continuing on. And because those are 1.x releases, they are backwards compatible with, I'll put a small asterisk there so we can get back to this asterisk, but, like, effectively, every time a new Rust comes out, every 6 weeks, you should be able to download the new version of the compiler and just use it with no problems.
Yep.
It should just work. And this is really important to us because it allows us to rapidly improve the language while not forcing the users to go through a large upgrade process, which splits the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to do this successfully, though, you can't just put out these releases immediately. So what we have is this, we call it the train model, where we have three different release channels. So there's stable releases, beta releases, and nightly releases. And so how it works is, you said you downloaded Rust 1.3. On the day when Rust 1.3 came out, we also released 1.4 beta, which is the release candidate for the next version of Rust that's coming out 6 weeks from now.
Mm-hmm.
And we started working on, master turns into Rust 1.345, which would be the version 2 weeks out. So you are, sorry, two releases out, which is 12 weeks out. So what happens is we have this 6 week period where we can test the new releases with the existing ecosystem and make sure that we haven't broken anything. And we actually have a tool called Crater, which runs across, it can say, here's a compiler version, please run this across every open source Rust package that we know of, and tell us which ones fail to compile now.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah, it's really cool. And we're hoping to extend it to closed source applications in the future. There's obviously some like NDA work and stuff that would be involved in doing that. That's, in the far future kind of thing. But the idea is that we can actually tell you ahead of time, oh, hey, we accidentally introduced a regression. Let's fix it before the release comes out. Or, hey, this is a problem. So getting back to that asterisk really quickly, because Rust is focused on safety, if we find a hole in our safety stuff, we still reserve the right to break code. Mm-hmm. And so this has happened once already where the compiler was a little too liberal in the syntax that it accepted, and we accepted some stuff that was like suboptimal. So what we did in that situation was we introduced a new warning that said, hey, this code is actually not correct. It will still compile for now, but 2 or 3 releases from now, it will stop compiling. You should probably upgrade. Here's a link to how to upgrade your code.
That's awesome.
And in this case, it was super trivial. It was literally like add 5 characters onto every place that you're using this, because one of the nice things about these kinds of updates is usually the wrong behavior is nothing that you intended or relied on to work. So it's literally like, we're going to disallow this invalid expression in the future. Please annotate this with the right thing to make it do the right thing, and then we'll upgrade someday. But we were able to figure out what release do we need to push this off to make it an effectively non-breaking change for the ecosystem, because we had a list of packages that would be broken, and we were able to send pull requests to those packages so that by the time the release would come out someday in the future, users would just never notice the problem.
It sounds like a very unique implementation of, break-fix testing, going through all those open source projects just and running them. That's great.
Yeah, it's cool. And so, we focus and we care a lot about this kind of stability, and we do a lot of work. One of the things that's unfortunate, though, is because we're so open about it and because we care so much, we often, but there's a certain group of people online who like to use it as weapons that we break stuff more often, because we always know when we break a thing. And so we're real upfront about, there has been 2 breaking changes so far. And then people are like, you're introducing breaking changes when you said you would never do that. And it's right. We said we would only do it in a certain circumstance, and we're very upfront about knowing exactly how and how much this will break, and we're taking all that into consideration when we're making these choices. Like, we extended one of those releases 2 releases further to make sure that it would be effectively a not breaking change for people, but because we're so transparent about it, it can be used as ammunition against us, which is kind of unfortunate.
Well, it's the internet too.
So I guess that's what I mean is, we care a lot about this and making sure that if you use Rust, you can freely upgrade without having to worry about it. And we go to great lengths to make that happen, I guess, is the sort of TLDR. Mm-hmm. It also means that you can test out new releases a lot earlier because we have this sort of lead time. So there's a lot of packages that do this testing for us as well, because in CI, they run on beta as well as the most recent stable release and just verify, that, okay, the next release that comes out is going to be fine too. Right. And that's a really nice thing for the ecosystem health overall.
Now, let's talk a little bit about package management. So, you mentioned that you've got cargo. In different languages, they are good or bad for certain things. So I know I'm doing a lot of Node right now and a lot of Angular. And so I'm in that world of using NPM constantly. And we have that NodePy or JitPy program that does native compiles when it builds things. And nothing works right. And you're wrestling with it forever and ever. Rust being a lower level language that compiles everything, how do you maintain a stable package manager?
So one of the things that we sort of do is we have strong conventions. So by default, you can change these through configuration, but by default, we assume that the source lib.rs file is the main entry into your package, for example. And so that means that once you're used to these conventions, you can get up to speed very quickly, and it's easy to sort of jump into a new project and see kind of how it works.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, which is nice.
I say that from a Maven user for years. So
yeah. You can also tweak that if you want, though. So, mm-hmm. for example, I just found out this morning that Twitter has actually released a new tool written in Rust that does performance testing for web services that provide an RPC service. And they're actually vendoring all their dependencies, and so they have the proper configuration to do that instead of downloading from crates.io, for mm-hmm. example. And so we also, while we have these strong conventions, we allow you to configure almost anything that you want separately as well. But what we try to do is provide nice defaults, so you don't have to think about it too much. So one of the examples that that I like to bring up here is it's very common in compiled languages for you to have two flags. One of them is dash G and one of them is dash O. And dash G turns on debugging symbols so that GDB can like work properly when you're doing stuff.
Right.
And dash O turns on optimizations, lets you set optimization levels, usually 0, 1, 2, or 3, right? So we have tried with Cargo to make the defaults do the right things. So for example, if you type cargo build, we will invoke the compiler with debugging symbols, the dash G by default, and you don't have to think about it.
Great.
If you compile with cargo build dash dash release, we automatically add in the dash O 3 optimization and don't add in the debug symbols.
Nice.
So you sort of like just get this kind of stuff automatically and you don't have to think about it too hard. And so we try to make this sort of and abstract over those kinds of options so that you just get something that's sensible. You can, of course, tweak those. It's very common. So some applications really rely on heavy optimizations to work at all. Mm-hmm. And they also want to be able to debug them. So you need both of those flags. So there's a way to configure that if you want. But sort of the default is like what works for most people.
Much like the Rails community, the defaults, the way you approach something are the sensible things.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't be surprised. Be delighted.
Right. And so that's sort of one of the things we try to do with our package manager as well. The other one is because like it's kind of just recursive, like because a project is built with Cargo, if your project is built with Cargo and you depend on that project, it knows how to build it because then Cargo just invokes itself on the sub project.
Yeah.
Right. So part of that is just the fact that because we don't have a fragmented ecosystem involving this stuff, it's really easy to build random packages because all of the packages use Cargo already, so they just know how to build each other, and that's significantly simpler. Now, if you need to integrate with native stuff or with some other build tool, we do have ways to support that as well. So there's sort of like a build.rs script that runs arbitrary Rust code that you can then do stuff. So say you depend on libxml because you're using it instead of a pure Rust implementation for some reason, you can link to the system libxml, or you can download, build, and compile your own libxml if you want to using these kind of build scripts. And that's sort of our that's sort of our thing that's similar to something like non GYP to be able to like integrate with other ecosystems. And one thing that Cargo is not perfect at yet is building extremely low-level projects like operating systems. So I actually have a hobby OS in Rust that I'm working on, and I use Cargo to build all the Rust code, but then I use NASM to compile the assembly code and then use LD directly to link the two together. So I actually have a make file that's then driving Cargo. And that's also an option if for some reason you have something that's outside of the scope of what's normally happening. But that's something I literally only see in operating system projects and like not in normal applications whatsoever.
Just because it would take so long to rebuild the whole thing, right?
Exactly.
Is this like your solution for incremental compile till that comes into language, or has that been added?
So what happens is currently we call packages crates. Technically, a package can consist of multiple crates. A crate is like the final output file, so the final binary, the final library file.
Got it.
And so we can compile each crate in parallel, but we can't compile within a crate in parallel currently. So incremental compilation, as we talk about in Rust, is going to be about only recompiling the portion of the crate in an incremental fashion. And so that work is still ongoing. And sort of what it has kind of, it's worked pretty reasonably so far, because basically what this means is you have a very node kind of ecosystem where people make a lot of small packages, because smaller packages, get compiled at the same time. So if you have one big package or five smaller packages, you'll get five parallel compiles if you use the smaller ones, but only one compile if you use the bigger one. So it's kind of encouraged a small package ecosystem, which is nice for other reasons as well.
That's not such a bad thing, right?
But big projects still do have longer build times, and so we still care a lot about adding incremental compilation within a crate for those things. So, for example, a clean build of Servo takes about 15 or 20 minutes on my computer, and I would much prefer that to... I mean, that's a clean build with all the dependencies, too. Mm-hmm. A real build takes 2 or 3 minutes. I would like that to take seconds, and so incremental compilation is how we'll accomplish that. But that's being worked on actively as we speak. It's not done yet.
Let me switch gears on you a little bit. So I was listening to one of your other podcasts that you did, and they were talking about embedding Rust in other languages.
Yeah.
Why and how would you do that?
So the Y is sort of what I alluded to earlier with the Ruby extensions kind of thing. It's like normally you have to drop down into C directly. A lot of languages are able to speak to C, right? So you're able to expose C and then read into C in almost anything, which mm-hmm. is what a lot of languages do. But if you say, if you want to write an extension in that other language, you need to bring that language's runtime along with you. And so, for example, if you're embedding, Lua is a very common, and I'm not saying it's dumb to use Lua in this case, but I just want to use it because it's very common in this yeah. instance. If you embed a Lua app, if you embed a Lua library into your Ruby application, you also bring along the Lua runtime, which in Lua's case is very small, mm-hmm. But you pay that overhead. And because Rust has no runtime, it's hard. So every language that's not assembly has a runtime. But there's sort of this giant chasm between languages that have what we conventionally say no runtime, which technically means basically no runtime.
A basic standard library.
Yeah, like C and C++ don't have a heavyweight runtime. Like the runtime basically is like set up a stack, and then call me or whatever. Finished. Right? It's just a minor tiny thing. But languages like Ruby have a really big, heavy runtime because you need the garbage collector and you need all the other stuff that goes along with the interpreter. And so Rust falls into this C-like runtime, not the Ruby-like runtime. And so you can write extensions in other languages, but the big advantage is that you lose all the overhead involved in bringing two runtimes together, basically.
So if you were writing a audio device reader or something like that in Rails... not a Rails app, that's a dumb example, but in some sort of Ruby app.
I have a similar example, actually, that's from my real life. So I had a startup a very long time ago, and what my startup did was, it was kind of like EC2, but with 3D printers instead. Mm-hmm. So you'd like upload a 3D file, and then we had an army of 3D printers, and we'd farm the job out to the appropriate one, and they would build the thing.
Nice.
And so that was a Rails app, but in order to figure out how much it would cost, because people want to know how much a thing is before they buy it, I had to write a thing that would analyze the 3D geometry of the file and then figure out how expensive it would be to actually print. And so in order to do that, I actually used C and wrote a C extension to my Rails app because you don't want, for something that's like as numeric computing intense as that is, you don't really want to be using Ruby because numeric computing is something Ruby is terrible at, right?
Yeah.
So I wrote this C extension that used C to do this analysis and then, spit out the answer, which they would then pass back to the Rails app, and the Rails app would then say, okay, that'll be $50 or whatever. So in that instance, it would be nice today, what I would do if I had to build that app again, would be I would build that extension in Rust instead. Because again, I'm doing effectively the same thing as I would be doing in C, no runtime, very efficient, but I don't have to drag along a whole second expensive set of stuff along with it. And so that's sort of the reason to use Rust for embedding is like, it is safer than C and it has the same performance characteristics and the same like overhead characteristics.
Okay. So kind of wrapping up here or at least coming over to the community more than the technical things. I'm getting a real kick out of some of the names of some of these things in your ecosystem. So I love the Rust Demonicon.
Yeah.
I was hoping it was stress leather bound. And
Yeah. We've been joking about we wanted to give it a dark theme by default. So all of our docs are like light on dark, dark on light. And we were saying like, we should make the Nomicon be a light on dark instead because it just feels right.
You say Orcus three times, it kills you or something. I don't know.
Yeah. For the listeners who don't know what that is, one of our people that implemented all the low-level data structure stuff wrote a sort of guide to... So Rust gives you this escape hatch in unsafe code, which lets you sort of do anything you would do in C. The bar checker does not check your work. You're kind of on your own. And that's necessary when you want to do the absolute lowest level stuff. Mm-hmm. And so this guide was written to how to write unsafe code, and we called it the Rustonomicon because it's the dark arts of Rust programming.
That's why it's called that. I was wondering I thought it was just some joke, but now it makes sense. It's the unsafe stuff. That's hilarious.
Yeah. It's all the unsafe stuff. Yeah, it definitely should be like leather bound with like a screaming face on it or something.
Seriously, yeah. And then there's Rustations. People who develop on Rust.
We wanted a good name, and so that was one that somebody came up with. And we have our unofficial mascot is Ferris the Crab. is the Rustation? His name is Ferris because Ferris sounds like Ferrous, iron, right? So it's
There's a web framework called Iron for Rust that I saw. It looks like it's a little old, but...
Iron and Nickel are the two big ones right now, actually.
What's the other one? I'm sorry?
Nickel.
Nickel.
Same thing, yeah. And it's Iron is kind of like Express in the same way. I don't know if you saw the recent drama about, like, is Express still maintained because somebody hadn't pushed a commit in like 2 months or something?
Oh my God, yeah. We actually pulled that in a dev news and I had to remove it because I was like, yeah, this is a little too rough, you know?
So when you have really small, tiny libraries, they do what they do and they do it well. And that means they don't need to be updated very often. And so Iron is definitely not old. It's just that it's very small and focused, and a lot of the stuff is in extensions.
And it's stable enough at the core. They don't really have changes.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a thing that we're sort of grappling with, not just in Rust, but I think in the broader programmer ecosystem, is like, we demand that our tools be stable and useful and don't break all the time. But we also demand that they have a commit sometime in the last week, or else we think they're abandoned.
Yes,
and those
that's
two
very
desires
true.
Are totally opposed.
Yeah, they're polar opposites in a way.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a thing.
Yeah. So I know that there was a really good guide out there. If you go to the rustlang.org site, you can go and see, you know, a good tutorial. What are some of the places that people who are beginners would hang out and would be a good place to look?
So one interesting thing about Rust, and this is something we've been thinking about and dealing with in some ways, is that we have probably, I'm just going to say it, the friendliest IRC channel on the internet.
Awesome.
And that's like a not a very high bar, obviously.
that's true.
And so that's a problem. But we also, you know, want to support free and open standards. And so IRC is like the way that you chat online if you care about free and open stuff.
Yeah.
And so we have a little bit of problem sometimes convincing people that our IRC is like made up of humans who are actually nice. So we explicitly have a number of IRC channels, but one for beginners specifically is #RustBeginners with a dash in it. And that room is specifically tailored to people who are new at Rust and want to get help. And I myself and a number of other people are there all the time willing to help you out. And we explicitly don't log the channel because we want people to feel comfortable with asking dumb questions. Yeah. If you go back and like look, and you know, obviously no questions are dumb, but people feel like they are. If you go back and look at me in the Rust IRC room logs, you can find me like 4 years ago asking like, how does Hello World work again?
I don't know.
I don't know how this worked, right? And so we specifically have that room. The main Rust IRC room has like 1,200 people or something in it right now. And so that can also be intimidating to new people asking a question in a huge active room.
Yeah,
so we made this smaller Rust beginners room for people who are new to Rust that want to ask questions in a place that will feel a lot more comfortable to them. And so that's like a great way to get help basically immediately. If you're in some time zones that are, you know, a little harder, obviously there's less or more people available based on time zones. But generally speaking, you can get questions answered really quickly. We also have a discourse at users.rustlang.org. Is open for questions of any kind, and a lot of help goes on there. And then Stack Overflow, there's a couple people who really are up on Stack Overflow and answer questions pretty quickly. It's rare that I see a question that has not already been answered by someone else. And so those are three great places to go to get help if you're learning Rust. And we specifically really encourage new people and want to help you learn Rust. So just ask, and we are happy to help you get into Rust if that's something you want to do.
That's really great. Now, your talk is going to be kind of a beginner's talk?
In some ways, yeah. It's going to not be super advanced, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain Rust through concurrency. So one of the interesting things, again, marketing is hard, is that this low-level safety stuff like sounds nice to some people and like, oh, pointers are good, but like other people are like, I don't have those problems. And so one of the things that's like a second order aspect of Rust is that this pointer safety means that we also, I think that Rust is possibly one of the best languages to write multi-process concurrent code, parallel concurrent code in. And the reason why is that those same guarantees that we do about like pointer stuff also gives us compile time concurrency errors as well. So like if you share a mutable thing across two threads in Rust without synchronization, you'll get a compile time error saying, hey, you're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's super fantastic. And so one of the ways I've been approaching a here's a new Rust talk is to be like, let's talk about concurrency and why it's hard and how Rust's approach to concurrency is a little different than many other languages. And so it's going to kind of be a beginner talk, but I'm going to do it focused around concurrency because I think that's a really interesting way to introduce Rust rather than sort of a feature-based approach, sort of more of like a problems-based approach.
Great. All right. Well, Steve Klabnik, he's going to be speaking at Philly Emerging Tech on the Rust framework, and we will see you there.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on this, and yes, happy to see you all there in a couple weeks.
Thanks to Steve Klabnik for speaking with us on the podcast. For more information about his projects, visit him at www.steveklabnik.com. Klabnik spelled K-L-A-B-N-I-K. For help on getting started with Rust, visit rust-lang.org website and click on the documentation link. There you'll find the Rust programming language ebook, the Rustonomicon, How to Program in Unsafe Mode in Rust, and other resources. As mentioned in the interview, the Rust community is very welcoming. Visit their IRC channels, including hashtag rust-beginner on irc.mozilla.org. If you liked this interview, you may enjoy our upcoming conference, Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise. Held in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania on April 11th to 12th, 2016, the conference features roughly 50 speakers talking about languages, frameworks, mobile and web applications, infrastructure, big data, and much more. For more information, visit phillyemergingtech.com. But hurry, tickets are going fast. The TechCast is created by Chariot Solutions, a full-stack application development consultancy committed to building high-quality software solutions. With expertise in Java, Scala, iOS, Android, Angular, and other open-source technologies, we can bring the right blend of expertise to bear for your organization. Visit us on the web at chariotsolutions.com. For show notes, visit us at chariotsolutions.com/techcast. This is episode number 92. You can also send us feedback via Twitter at techcast and via email at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com. Thanks for listening. This is producer Rebecca Refford signing off.